Today, in honor of all those athletes heading to the Winter Olympics in Sochi, we're talking about people who've achieved remarkable things in epic cold temperatures. For instance, Jill Fredston. She and her husband have rowed more than 20,000 miles of Arctic water. A couple of years ago, she wrote a beautiful book about their adventures, rowing the coastlines of Alaska and Canada and Greenland. It's called Rowing to Latitude. And when the book came out, she told Jim Fleming that every day of these trips is
the kind of day where so much happens, you can't believe how lucky you are to be on Earth in this place. And we saw three polar bears, one of which was just swimming right alongside us. We saw a bird rookery with more birds than we'd seen in our lives, with the baby birds making their first flight. And then we did a crossing in the fog, and rowing in fog is pretty disorienting. You almost sometimes can't figure out if you're pulling through water or air. So after an hour of this crossing, I started looking over my shoulder for land and made out the slope, and then I made out this thing that didn't make any sense at all. And one of the things we're taught to do in rescue work in Alaska is, let's say we're looking for a down plane. You don't look for a plane because it may not look like a plane anymore. So you look for something that doesn't look like everything else around it. And I kept doing that, and finally I asked Doug if he saw what I was seeing above my head, and he didn't even look. He laughed, and finally, the fog cleared, and I was right. There was this whale that was just hanging up on the side of the mountain that was about 20 feet long. It was missing its head, and the question was, how did it get there? Did it get pushed up by a big wave, or did it melt out of the glacier that had retreated about a half mile around the corner? And we told some scientists about it when we got back to the one town there is a month later. And
their reaction, by the way, if I remember correctly, was about the same as Doug's, that you could not possibly have seen what you were saying.
They didn't really believe us. Yeah, they didn't think we had a lot of credibility. But they finally went and dated it. And about 2 years later, a paper showed up with the results.
How old was it?
It dated between 1535 and 1660. So it lived in Shakespeare's time. And that was the Little Ice Age. So what must have happened is the whale died, floated up on the beach, was incorporated into this glacier, advancing glacier, and now the glaciers have retreated and it dropped out.
That same day, as you said, you saw three polar bears. Each time, again, if I remember correctly, you were trying to find a place to camp. Must have been great frustration.
We were tired. The winds were blowing 80 miles an hour, fortunately offshore. So if we went right along the shore, we were okay. But yeah, every time we tried to pull in on a beach, a polar bear had beat us to it.
Is this typical? Knowing that that's going to happen, you continue to go out to do this, so it must not be too frustrating.
My family keeps wondering why we've rowed 21,000 miles in the north and never gone anywhere where the water is warmer than 45 degrees. And I think the reason is that we really like wild country. And for the most part, the wild country is going to be where there's the fewest people. And that's going to tend to be where the weather has its challenging moments.
Tell me about your boats.
The boats have evolved over the years. For the first 13,000 miles, Doug was in a kayak and I was in a rowing boat. What I mean by a rowing boat is it's essentially a kayak hull, but it has a different deck on top. So it has a sliding seat and 9-foot-9 oars, so you're sculling. And the boat's about 19 and a half feet long, weighs 65 pounds. We go in two boats, which I think is one secret to liking each other when you're spending 4 or 5 months together. If we need to, we can hold as much as 100 days of food. We'd rather not, because it sinks the boats right down to the gunwales. But having that much food also means tremendous range.
And you go out for months at a time.
What we do is we work 7 days a week in the winter as avalanche specialists in Alaska, and then we take off from May to September and just explore. And usually the trips are 3, 4, 5 months. It depends. We rode the coast of Norway from Sweden to Russia, which is about 2,500 miles, and that took about 5 months.
What do you think about when you're in a boat by yourself for 8 hours, rowing along?
It's funny because when people hear about these trips, they try to make us out as being brave or adventurous. And for the most part, I don't think that the miles are a function of strength or bravery. It's simply repetitive motion over a long period of time, a lot of strokes. And probably the hardest part of the trips is mastering yourself rather than trying to master the wind or the waves. And that is, what do you think about? And how do you keep yourself entertained sometimes? Most of the time, the country is just so intriguing that you're thinking about geology or you're thinking about history, or sometimes you're thinking about friends. On the Mackenzie River was really the only place where I've ever been so hot and tortured by mosquitoes that sounded like helicopters, that I couldn't think of anything to think about other than what I was going to think about. And that's pretty rare. But I actually bungee corded a book to my feet and tried to read as I rolled back and forth for 1,000 miles down this river.
How far did you get into the book?
I read all of Wallace Stegner's Angle of Repose, which is one of my favorite books.
I was going to say, if you're going to choose one, that's a good one to go along with. Another of the early trips that you took when you were rowing, but Doug, I think, was still kayaking, you ended up in a place with whales and found yourself out in the middle with a whale ready to surface under you. That sounds to me extraordinarily dangerous.
There were a lot of things on that first trip we didn't know. And one of the things we didn't know was if we were going to make it, because you sort of find out that people are very quick to tell you what you can't do. We didn't know that we saw the world differently until what you're talking about with this whale. And we were about 1,000 miles up the Inside Passage. It was a beautiful blue sky day. There was a humpback whale swimming about 100 yards away from us, just paralleling us for a couple miles. And we were just right along the rocks. And then we reached a 3-mile-wide bay where we had to leave the security of the shoreline behind and cross. And that whale chose that moment to disappear. So as we looked across this bay, there was no sign of it anywhere. So I said, Doug, let's wait and see where this whale shows up. And Doug said, we waited a few minutes. And then he said, well, you know, we could wait forever. Let's go. And he's learned to listen to me at least most of the time because we got about 2/3 of the way across this bay. And Doug looked down. He said, look, Jill, there's bubbles here. And I looked down and I said, oh, yeah, there's bubbles here, too. And I'm generally rowing about 15 feet ahead of him and looking back towards him because he's in the kayak facing forward. And then we realized that the bubbles just weren't right next to us, but they were in a circle that was about 60 feet around. And humpback whales feed by emitting this tiny circle of bubbles. And the fish think that they're in a net. So they go towards the middle, and the middle is where the whale is. And where the whale is, there's this big lens of whale breath. And as Doug looked down, the big bubble of whale breath was about 15 feet underneath them and coming up fast.
You pulled faster, perhaps, than you would ordinarily pull at that point.
Yeah, and as we were paddling with everything we had away, this whale burst from the water about 10 feet behind where Doug was. So I had a perfect view of it since I was facing that direction. Its tail was about 12 feet wide and had water streaming off the tail. And Doug, as he's, you know, red-faced, is saying, take a picture, Jill, take a picture. I said, forget it. What was funny about that story is that night we were on shore and we talked about where we were in relation to the whale and what had happened, and our stories just didn't jive at all. I mean, it was as though we had seen different whales in separate oceans. And the more we talked about it, the madder we got. And I was sure I was right. And Doug was absolutely convinced he was right. And he'd never even seen the whale. So finally, he suggested that we each draw pictures, kind of sketch the scene of how we saw it. And we looked at these pictures, and they just didn't jive at all. And we got madder, so mad that Doug was sitting right next to me, and all I could think of is, you know, where had he learned to suck in so much air so loudly, and where had he learned to breathe like that? And then he started to laugh, and it was one of these deep laughs that seemed very disrespectful of my view. And when he finally got the breath to explain, he said that we had drawn the same picture, but that I had drawn mine facing backwards the way I look when I row, therefore towards both him and the whale. And he had drawn his facing the other way. And it was a question of perspective. He still insists, quite annoyingly to this day, that I had drawn my picture upside down.
Jill Fredston is the author of Rowing to Latitude, Journeys Along the Arctic Edge. Jim Fleming talked with her when the book was first out.